It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Blog Talk Radio.
Young, my teacher told me that I was free, yeah. And as a child, I grew up programmed by TV, yeah. And as a teenage boy, I found out just how free is free.
Thank you. gentlemen, welcome to the Rifleman Radio Show. Thank you for listening, and I thank the folks that are listening live tonight, and the folks that are going to listen, download it into the archives later. If you're listening live, you're welcome to call in, 347-308-8790, 347-308-8790. Sam D will answer the phone, and he'll ask you what you want to do. Now, if you call in and you don't want to talk, if he opens your line and asks you, don't worry, he won't be on the air. He'll be doing it off air. But we appreciate you calling in to add your experiences. I certainly don't know, anywhere near everything on anything I talk about, and I'm always willing to listen to other folks' experiences, other folks' advice. That's why I pay for 50 phone lines. So be sure and call in if you have any questions, if you want to make any comments about any of the stuff that we're talking about tonight, or any of the stuff we have in the past, or things you want to hear in the future. You're welcome to call in at any time. There's also a live chat that follows the show. Whenever you open up the show page, there is a button to click for live chat. I'd like to thank a lot of the folks that help out with the show. Of course, Sam D. He's every time we open the microphones, Sam is here and ready to go, ready to screen the calls or take over if my line gets cut, anything like that. And I really appreciate him doing that. So Sam, thank you. And then there's a lot of other folks. My wife would have to be next on the list because she keeps the rest of the crew's noise down to a minimum, and she brings me fresh cups of coffee, and she calls me in the morning to remind me that I have a show tonight, that I don't get carried away with work, and she loves me, and I love her. We're going to be talking about several things tonight. Last week we were talking about purified water, and I also during the same time I wanted to talk about I've been out in the 102 degree heat and dust all day. I must have drank probably at least 2.5-3 gallons of liquids, but it still seems like I'm coming up short. And when I say 2 or 3 gallons, I'm not exaggerating, and that's probably what I drank. And that can go back to what we discussed last week with water. When it's hot and you're moving around, you're going to be bleeding water out of your body everywhere. You're going to be sweating. It's going to be evaporating out of your eyes. You're going to, every breath you take, every time you exhale, whenever you take your glasses or you exhale onto a window and it fogs up, that's water vapor that's leaving your body when you breathe. So you're leaving, you're expelling water all day long. And the only real way that you can kind of tell if you're drinking enough water is that you should be having to urinate, and your urine should be kind of clear. It shouldn't be a just a small bit of a dark colored urine. It should be a steady flow of good, clear urine. I'm making it sound like a beverage, okay? I know a lot of people think that it is. I've seen that on the Survivor shows. The guys quaffing down their own urine. I don't know. I guess if it was life or death, I'm sure I'd probably do that too. But I don't practice it, and I've never been that close to perishing that I had to do that. However, whenever you urinate, you should be able to look at it and see that it should be fairly clear, and you should be drinking enough water that you're having to urinate, right? Because if you realize that during the course of the day that you have not had to urinate, that means that you're not taking in enough water to do the jobs that are supposed to be being done with the water. The water is supposed to be helping keeping your blood flowing, because your blood is pretty much mainly just water. And it's flowing through your body, through all the organs. It's allowing your blood to flow freely through all the veins and capillaries. And that blood is, as it's moving through there, it's carrying away heat. Heat from the muscles, and it's also carrying away the stuff your body is trying to excrete, you know, the unneeded stuff. So make sure that you're drinking enough that you're urinating, and that the urine is a good clear color, not a light flow of dark red. Right, that's a sign that you're not drinking enough. All right, going back to the water, we talked a good bit about it. Now, I told folks one of the things that you want to make sure you do in your home, especially folks living in the cities and everywhere else, you want to make sure that you're storing enough water. Guys, at least a minimum of 3 or 4 days of water. Now, that's 1 gallon per person, just for drinking, 1 gallon per person per day. And that is with you in 75 degrees in the shade, not doing anything, all right? If it's hotter and you're going to have to be doing stuff, it's going to be more. That's just the way it works. But we were talking about it, and I told you that one of the places that you can store water and at the same time improve your chances of getting through at least a few days of a power outage is in your freezer. Your freezer compartment should be packed solid with water containers. They should be filling any voids that are in there in your freezer. There shouldn't be big open chunks of air, because your refrigerator has to work harder to cool those open holes of air, and every time you open the door, and sometimes you can actually see this, every time you open the door, you'll see it flow out. You'll see that air come cascading down out of those open shelves, hit the floor and spread out, and that is wasting it. So make sure you have a stock of plastic bottles on hand that you can plug in there. Fill all those voids. Then if your power goes out, you'll have solid ice in there that can help get you past, you know, a few days of the power being out. It can extend the life of the food and stuff in there, because if the power goes out and you have a bunch of void in there, if you have only have like 50% filled up with stuff, then it's going to reach temperatures which may cause troubles pretty quick. And you want to be able to extend lifetime use, the usage of the stuff that you put in the fridge as long as possible. We talked about boiling water. We talked about adding chlorine to it, and several other things. If you Google water purification, you'll find that there's quite a few methods that folks are talking about there and giving demonstrations of. You can make your own water filters fairly easily, and you can make it out of emergency stuff too. When we talked about the plastic liter bottles, and making sure that you are pre-filtering your water, stuff like that. All right? Okay. The next thing that I want to talk about is fire starting. And this is another of the legs, of the five legs, the five tenets of survival. You have water, food, shelter, energy, and security. These are the five main things that you need to consider. Now, they all have subcategories, and there are certainly other things you could add into it, but those are the five main things that you're going to need to consider for survival situations. And fire starting is going to fall under the heading of energy. In order for you to cook your food, in order for you to see, in order for you to keep warm, all of these things, you're going to require energy. And so you're going to have to create energy. If you don't have a constant flow of electricity, then you're going to need some way to create the energy. And I'm talking about whether you're in your house or you're out on the side of a mountain. It's both the same thing. If you're in your house, you're still going to have to, and the electricity is off, you're still going to have to figure out some way of cooking your food, of maybe lighting the darkness. And certainly if you're out in the outdoors, you're certainly going to have some way of doing this. And obviously the first thing that we want to consider, going to be the easiest thing, is having on hand a supply of the Bic lighters, you know, the little inexpensive disposable lighters. Those are going to be probably one of the best things that you can keep on you to start a fire. You can buy them relatively cheap. I've been buying them in bulk for quite a while now because I don't know if you guys remember the two guys, the one guy in Argentina, Furfal, and then Selko from the Balkans. And they both spoke about this, but mainly Selko was talking about the fact that, you know, once the utilities had ended, it means you couldn't turn the knob on the stove to get the electricity in there, or you once you ran out of gas, that was, you know, the propane cooking gas. Once you ran out of the gas, there's no more. People had to cook on wood fires, on charcoal, stuff like that, and they had to light it. And we don't think about this much because we can, if we need to light something on fire, we just go and grab some matches that we keep on hand, or we go and grab some of the lighters that we have. But eventually, matches all get burned up, lighters run out of gas. And the same thing can happen to you, even if you have lighters. Your lighter can malfunction, it can go dead. If you spend any time clicking lighters, you know that they can fall apart and become unusable. But that is the first thing that I would make sure that I had, that I kept in the home and in my go bag, in my rucksack, in my car glove boxes, in the drawers of any of the places that I stayed on a regular basis. And that's the lighters. Cole was also talking about how the lighters became a very much in-demand item of barter. You know, people needed the lighters to do everything they were going to do with energy. So they would consider the lighters to be a really big value bartering item. Some of the folks even developed businesses where they could refill the disposable lighters for you. The disposable, even the disposable lighters usually have a little filling plug on the bottom. And some of the local craftsmen have figured out how to generate methane, compress it, and then fill the lighters with it. Or some, you know, or they had some stash of propane or tane, something. But they were they had a pretty good business going where they were refilling the lighters for folks. So make sure that you have the lighters on hand. I don't know if they've changed all around the nation, but for a couple of years, you could go to places like Dollar General, and you could buy 10 lighters for $2.50. They came out to about 25 cents a piece. And I just put that on my list of things to purchase when I went up to the Dollar General, like once a week. I would allocate like 10 bucks that I could spend on stuff on my list, either for barter or survival, stuff like that. And I would purchase, once a week, I'd purchase a 10-pack. Now they've gone down in the number of lighters that they're going to give you for that $2.50. Now it's 5 lighters for $2.50. So they've gone up to 50 cents a piece. But still, if you put that on your budget, once or twice a week, you can rapidly develop, a good stock of lighters. Thing would be matches. And certainly matches are inexpensive now. They used to have the Strike Anywhere matches. And I guess after a while, they became alarmed at the fact that the white tips could be taken off of the Strike Anywheres and used as an explosive item, I think. And so now, very hard to find any of the old Strike Anywheres with the picric acid tips. You can still, however, buy the boxes with the large amount of big wooden matches. You can buy them really pretty cheaply and any of the places like Walmart or HEB, stuff like that. Now you can buy those big boxes of diamond matches. I would advise stocking up on those as well. And the matches are going to come in a cardboard box. And one of the things I would certainly do with those is when you're – now, I put everything in Ziplocs just because it's easier to keep track of. I put them in the Ziplocs, right on the outside with a black Sharpie, what's in it, how many. When I put it in there. But I would put the matches, I'd make sure I put them in a nice, tight Ziploc bag, and go ahead and pay a little bit extra for your Ziplocs and get the really good, the high-quality storage Ziplocs, not the real thin plastic ones. We can get the high-quality storage ones. And then you can also hop onto eBay and buy yourself a pound or two of the desiccants off of eBay, the little desiccant packs that you find in all the different products. You can buy a pound or two of those on eBay fairly inexpensively and get in the habit of saving the ones that come to you in any of the other products that you purchase. If you buy some device or something that has a desiccant pack in it, save it. Get yourself a mason jar, any kind of glass jar, anything with a good tight fitting seal, and throw them in there so that you can use them later on for stuff like this. Take the the wooden match boxes, put them in the Ziploc bag, throw one of the desk kit packages in there, seal it up nice and tight, make sure that the matches don't suck up moisture, and put them away wherever you're going to put them away. Those are, can also be good barter devices. Now, a lot of people, you know, whenever you talk about matches or lighters for them starting fires, you get almost the same arguments with that you do when you start asking people about firearms. You know, which ones, which is the best one to use. So, and everyone will have their opinions, and both are good. I like matches when starting fires because it's got the wood going there itself. It's going to burn for a good amount of time, and usually I can keep my fingers kind of far away from where I'm trying to start the fire. But you can use either one. So you've got the butane lighters, you've got the matches, and like I said, be sure and put them away in a very dry container. I've also got matches that I store in glass jars, and for those, I'll just take. A lot of times, I'll take the matches out of the wooden boxes. I'll put them into the glass jars with a jar laying on its side until I fill it up, and I'll put two or three layers in there, which instead of being all mixed together, jumbled up, I'll just make sure they all go into the jar in the right, standing up. I'll pack it full, and I'll cut the Strike Anywhere tabs off of the containers. There's usually a large strip all the way down one side on or both sides of the box. I'll cut those out, put those in there too, and I'll store matches that way. They used to make, I haven't seen it in quite a while, but they used to make the match, the dry lock match containers, and with those you could put two, three, maybe even four dozen kitchen matches in there, with the heads up. The container was kind of shaped almost like a vase, so you could put them all in there, and you could screw on a watertight lid. I still have a couple of those, and I still use those. If for nothing else, I like using the wooden matches. If I happen to come across a cigar at my end of the world travels, I'll have something to light it with. If you have neither of those, what are you going to do? How are you going to figure it out? How are you going to fix it? Well, there's a number of ways that you can start fires without matches. Or a lighter, and I'm sure that everybody has seen the stick method, the bow and stick method, and that is certainly a viable option. It can be done. People do it all the time. However, I'll warn you that the time to learn, build, and use a bow drill or any kind of a friction device is not going to be when you are stranded someplace and it's dark and cold. The time to learn how to start a fire with a friction device, with a bow drill, anything like that, is going to be now when you're not depending on it. Before we go any further with the different methods, let's start off with talking about building your fire, building the nest. That's got to be the first thing that you do, no matter what method you're using. You're going to have to build a nest to incubate that fire. And that's whether you're using a lighter, matches, flint and steel, magnifying glass, hand drill, any of these, a bow drill, any of these methods, it's going to require that you lay your fire correctly first. This is one of the problems that I always see when folks are trying to start fires, is that they fail to understand like the dynamics of a fire, and they fail to lay it properly. Listen, you can get a fire started in almost any weather, any condition, if you have laid your fire correctly. And that begins with building a tinder nest. Now, when I talk about building a tinder nest, when you lay a fire, you're going to start with the very smallest particles of combustible material that you can get and work up from there. And what you're going to use is going to depend on where you are. It's going to depend on what is the local vegetation consists of. One of the things you're almost always likely to see is some type of grass. And if you're out like in a prairie environment, that's great because there are a lot of grasses that will work well for you in any kind of a prairie type environment. And what you want to do is you want to look at the grasses, and you want to start selecting the pieces of the grasses that are long dead and are dried out. So what you'll do is, and listen, sometimes it takes a little while to gather up all this stuff to lay your fire correctly, but it's very important. Laying your fire is the most important part of this whole thing. No matter what method you're using, whether you're going to get a fire or not is going to depend on how well you laid your fire beforehand. Okay? So you're going to take the time to do it right. You're going to first gather your tinder. You can do that by collecting the dead grass, this dead, crispy, crunchy grass, even if you have to pop it off like one shard at a time. You can use dried leaves. You can use the dried out fibers from like seed pods, or you can use bark, especially like cedar bark is really good. Any kind of bark that has long strips in it is great. And then what you'll do is you'll take the tinder that you've gathered up, and you'll run it back and forth in your hand, kind of like you're rubbing your two hands together, like you would to produce friction. And you're doing that to further break down the fibers in that tinder, and make the particles of tinder smaller. Theoretically, what you'd like is to have nothing in your pile of tinder that was bigger around than maybe a fourth of a pencil lead in thickness or smaller. All right? If you can crumble your tinder down to where the pieces of tinder are about the size of what you get when you got a bundle of 9 or 10 hairs together, that's going to be great. That's going to be a good size for you. But break it down by rubbing it, by crunching it up, to get the smallest number of particles that you can get. Now, when you're doing this, if you can do it over a flat rock, or if you can get a big leaf to do it so that as you're crumbling it up, the pieces that are falling out of your hand are going into a pile that you can scrape back up together into a good pile as part of your tinder nest. You can use threads from your clothing if you have some clothing that's getting kind of has exposed threads, you can unravel threads. You can use those as part of your tinder, as long as it's a natural fiber, you know, wool, cotton, something like that. Nylon's not going to do you any good. So you're looking to make, to lay the tinder first. Once you've got a good pile of tinder, and I'd say that would be, what you can keep in cups in one hand, that's like a minimum amount that you want. Now, once you have the tinder, you also need to make to be careful with what you do with it. You don't want to just dump it so that it spreads apart and there's space in between it. It needs to be kept in a nice, tight ball. Now, however you can do that, I'll take it and I'll put it in on a piece of bark that can hold it in one pile. I'll put it into a crumpled up piece of paper, into a dry leaf, anything that you can do to keep that tinder together. That's what you want to do. Bird's nests usually have a good amount of tinder material in them if you can get to them, because the birds will make their nests in a dry place usually. And they will use all different kinds of dried vegetation, and then it'll just get drier as it's there in the nest. You can use that as your tinder. And there's been plenty of times when I've been able to take a bird's nest out of a tree. Now, there's no birds or eggs in it, but I've taken a bird's nest out of a tree, and I didn't have to do anything because it was already the perfect tinder pocket for me to start striking into. All right, once you've got your tinder, you're going to go to the next size. And these would be sizes of twigs that are going to be like maybe pencil lead or thinner thicknesses. You're going to gather up a handful of those that will be the next cover that will go on top of the tinder that you made. Progress up. You'll start getting sticks that are twice as thick as the pencil lead. And then you'll get sticks that are twice as thick as those. So it'll just slowly progress while you're building while you're laying the fire. You'll slowly progress with the size that you're making that you have available. Now, you're not going to pile everything up into a big pile at first. You can in some cases. I wouldn't recommend it. I would recommend just using your tinder and the first two thicknesses of twigs that you're going to use to get the fire started. That means that you'll make your little tinder cup, you'll set it there, and then you'll make it so that you can strike into it, you can put the match into it, you can put the glowing ember from the bow drill set into it. You have enough room to do that. And then the smaller twigs can be right on top. Now, I've seen other folks make, I don't know what they called it now, but it was like it's like kind of the same thing, but they were using like a piece of birch bark to hold it in place. And they were using that to, the birch bark rolled around the tinder so they could strike down, they could strike into, down into the tinder and that rolled up piece of birch bark. Whatever the case, you don't want to smother your fire out, and you don't want it to go from tinder, from your tinder to sticks that are the size of your finger. It's not going to make that jump. You're gradually leading the fire from one size to the next to the next. And believe me, the fire wants to be, it wants to become. So it wants to help you. It wants to burn. So as long as you don't make it too hard, the fire is going to do, it's going to do its thing, man. So what you want to do is to make a nice, easy path for it to follow. All right, so once you've got your tinder set up and you have your supply of twigs, because that's the other thing, you don't want to strike your fire into the tinder and then have it starting to glow and say, okay, now I got to run into some sticks. Because your tinder could very well burn itself out before it gets before you can find enough stuff for it to burn next of the right size, right? So have everything prepped and ready before you start on the actual making of the ember. Okay, so you don't have a lighter, you don't have matches. What's next? I went on eBay and I bought a handful of the Striker steels for making fire. You can get those really pretty cheaply from on eBay. Like I said, I bought I don't know how many it was, 8 or 10 of them for, it couldn't have been more than about, I think, $15 or so. And the way those work is you just take the bar, we'll take the bar and use either the striker, the metal striker that they provide with it, or you can use the back of your pocket knife. You could use a key. You can use any kind of sharp edge metal, and you'll run it down the side of it. This will create a shower of sparks. It'll actually be scraping off part of the core, and then those parts are ignited due to the friction as they come off, and they'll burn for just a fraction of a second usually, but they'll burn really hot, and they will ignite the tinder that you have put up there, usually very easily. And I already said, I'm going to say it again here though, that if I were you, I would make it a game. I would make it a game to start my fires, wherever I was starting them, with different methods of fire starting than matches or lighters. I'd make it a game to do it if I ever needed to light a fire. Yeah, even if you're going to light the fire for your dinner, for the charcoal grill, all right? You can clear some of the charcoal away, and you can put your tinder down there up against the briquettes, and you can use your flint and steel to get the fire started as part of your training, because you'll learn the easiest ways to do it. You'll learn what works and what doesn't work in an environment, in a situation that isn't completely compounded by stress and is not a life or death situation, all right? So practice laying and starting your fires now so that you'll know how to do it when you need to and you won't be stressed out doing it. One of the other things you can also use if you want to pre-prepare some tinder material are things like char cloth. That's where you've taken like a piece of cotton cloth, and you have charred it. You've set it on fire, but you've put the fire out before it consumed the fabric. And what that does is now allows like a bed for the spark to land on and catch the cloth with one of the sparks for a glowing ember, all right? So, excuse me. So be sure and practice these methods beforehand. What I do now is I'll just use one of probably 6 or 7 different methods. The only one I don't do all the time is the bow drill. But I've done it enough to know how to do it. Flint and steel are the thing that I usually use the most, and I that's because I've got those stashed everywhere now. So let's go ahead and go to the. Hold on just a second. Let's go to the bow drill, since that's what everybody thinks of when they think about starting a fire, because if you watch people do it in on TV and stuff like that, what you don't see is how long it takes them to do it. Usually they'll show them getting it set up and like starting to spin it or something, and then they'll cut out the next 1, 2, 3 hours of cursing and blisters and everything else. So how are you going to do the bow drill? You can use just a drill, which it would be a stick, and then another piece of wood that you would put it into, and use your hand, spinning your hand back and forth on the rod, and you're going to do it. You're going to hold it not tight. You hold it real tight. Your arms are going to tire out really quick, and those blisters are going to come a lot quicker than they need to come. You're probably going to get blisters doing it in some cases until you've perfected it. But you can certainly learn to do it in a way that doesn't cause the blisters right at first. What you're going to need is really the stick, the spindle, and the fireboard. Both need to be a dry, soft wood. That's things like aspen and juniper, cottonwood, willow, some type of a soft wood that is very dry. But now you could possibly use a spindle, that's the stick. You could use something that's made from maybe a little bit of a harder wood, as long as you made sure that one of the pieces was from a soft wood, preferably like the fireboard. You're going to need to spin it at a pretty decent speed for you to keep up the friction to get the ember started. Now, the friction of the spindle, you know, moving it back and forth, against the indentation in the fireboard, it starts to grind small particles off of both the surfaces. Let's talk about the end of the spindle and the fireboard now, because what you need to do is they need to match up kind of as closely as you can make them match up. You want to have an indentation in the fireboard. Carve it out. You can, take a rock of the right size and kind of gouge out the hole a bit. If you've got flint there, you can actually do like Cro-Magnon Man and chip you out a little, kind of like a little knife the size of the notch that you want made. And then use that to create your indentation. And the indentation, you should put it close enough to the edge of your fireboard that you can make, with your knife, you can make a little V-cut that is going to intersect the edge of the indentation. That's because whenever you start spinning it up, you start spinning the spindle against the notch in the fireboard, you're going to have little particles from both of the surfaces which are going to be in contact with each other under friction, under pressure and friction. And the end where the two things are meeting up actually needs to get pretty hot before the glowing coal will form, but you also need a way for that ember to get out of there. And you can do that by having a small V that intersects the very edge of your notch hole. Then you're going to take your hands, you're going to move them back and forth. You'll be holding the spindle like you're praying, like when you're on your knees praying. You're going to apply downward pressure as you are moving your hands back and forth. And then you're going to very rapidly get them back up the top and repeat, up the top and repeat. You're going to keep doing this until you can finally start to, you'll see some smoke coming at first. You'll see some smoke coming along before you ever get an ember. But the end of the spindle tip will glow, end up glowing red, and you'll have an ember. You'll tap the fireboard where you have the ember from the two. It should be loose in there, a little balled up piece of into an ember. And then you'll take and tap that and drop that into your tinder ball that you've made. Then you'll take your hands, you'll cup that tinder ball, not so that it squeezes it, but until you can get as many little particles of the tinder to come into contact with it as you can. Now, not completely closing around it, because you need to have one piece of the tinder exposed, because you're going to continue to blow on that. And you're blowing on it while you're putting it into contact with the tinder ball. And then your tinder ball should grow in size as you're gently blowing on it until you finally get enough of the tinder in your tinder ball glowing that you actually get an open flame to break out, okay? And then you can put your, start building it up from the neck sizes, you know? All right? Now, like I said, this is going to take a little while, and it's going to be hard on your hands. Now, you can certainly speed this up by going to the next level, and that's by adding a bow to your spindle fire. And the way you do that is when you're doing this, the spindle that you're using and the fireboard both need to be dry softwoods, okay? With the bow fire, you're going to do basically the same thing, except you're going to also have a cap that is going to be having an indentation in it, much like the one that you have for the fireboard. So both ends of your spindle be slightly rounded, and there'll be indentations in the fireboard and in the cap that you're going to be using to hold the top of the spindle in place. Then you're going to take a green sapling. There's probably going to be about twice the length of your spindle. Say your spindle's about a foot, 18 inches, something like that. It's not going to need to be as long for a bow fire as it is for a friction spindle, because you're not going to have to depend on your hands moving down the length of it and keeping it in touch, keeping it in contact with the thing. You're going to be using the cap to hold it in place, and then the bow is going to stay right at the same point. And what you'll do then is you'll take that, kind of make it into a shape like the bow, a bow and arrow. then you'll use something like a shoelace, a thin piece of rope, something that you can use to attach it to both ends of a sapling, so you now have like a bow. And then you'll take the bow part and you'll wrap it once around the spindle. Okay? It'll go around the spindle one time. Then you'll hold the bow in one hand. I hold it in my strong hand. I'm right-handed, so I hold it in my right hand. And I hold the bow in my right hand, and I hold the cap pressing down on top of the spindle, pressing the spindle into the fireboard with the other. Now, the bow, I hold it close to one end. You don't hold it in the middle. Then it wants to try and bend toward what you're doing instead of running it back and forth. And you'll have to experiment to find the right tension, the best tension on the string for your bow. And then what you're going to do is you're going to move it back and forth, almost like you were playing a violin. You're going to move it rapidly back and forth, okay? And you'll just do this until you get your glowing ember, and then you can tap that glowing ember into your tinder ball, into your tinder cup. Now, the different way you can do this is if you have two people. If you've got two people, then it can kind of make it a little bit easier. And you actually don't have to have a bow if you've got two folks. What you'll do is you'll have the string or shoelace or twine or light rope, whatever you're using. You'll have that wrapped around the spindle a couple of times. Then one person will be sitting there with their, like, I keep my left foot on the fireboard. I'm usually kneeling down on my right knee, left foot on the fireboard, left hand on the spindle cap, and then my right hand would be holding the bow. Now, if there's two people, the only thing that's going to be different is one person will be sitting there with their one foot on the fireplate and holding the cap onto the spindle, keep the spindle into contact with the fireplate. And then the other person will wrap the light rope, string, shoelaces, whatever, around the stick a couple of times, and they'll have one end in each hand. And they'll be pulling with the left hand and moving the right hand forward, then pulling back with the right hand, moving the left hand forward. They're just doing that back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until you've created enough friction that you get a glowing ember. Okay, so that is the two-person method of doing it. Now, you can also make a fire plow. This one takes a little bit of work. I think it takes a little more work than the bow drill, but once again, you can do it. And there are plenty of natives. This is the way that they start their fire all the time. They can start a fire up really quick, and so can you if you practice it. And here's what you're going to do. You're going to get your fireboard, but in this case, instead of having a round indention in it to fit the end of your spindle, you're going to, this is for a fire plow. You're going to cut a straight line that is just a tiny, tiny bit larger than the end of the spindle that you're going to be using. And your spindle, in this case, should probably be of a little bit harder wood than the fireboard, if you can manage to do that. Now, what you'll do with this is you'll cut the plow in the fireboard. And you're going to be holding the stick at about like a 45-degree angle. Pressure, the way I do that is I put my left hand down near the tip of it, and I hold my right hand, a little bit farther back from the tip, and you're going to be applying pressure as you're moving it back and forth, in a scraping motion. As you do this, there's going to be little tiny particles that you're going to be pushing, that you'll keep pushing ahead of you. And as the temperature, now, you can't ever stop. Once you start doing this, you can't stop until you get the ember. You have to start all over again. But what you're going to be doing is you're going to be applying friction. You're going to be pushing it back and forth, until you've created enough friction that you end up pushing a little ember out of the end of the fireboard into the pile of particles of wood that you have scraped out already, which are going to be landing into your tinder cup, into your tinder bowl. So you'll end up pushing the ember right out of the plow into the other particles of the dust that you scraped out, and that's all going to land in your little tinder cup, and then you'll do the same thing that you did with the other one. Once you have that little ember going, you'll start off just very gently blowing, and then you'll start to cupping it and pressing the sides together a little bit more until you have a nice glowing ember gently blowing on it. And then you can keep blowing on it, keep expanding the ember until it gains enough of a size that you get an open flame to start out on it. Like I said, it's a tricky way to do it, but it can be done. You can make a fire drill. I'm not going to go into this because really you need a little bit of a picture for this, but you can make a pump fire drill. Now, something like a pump fire drill, I would, you'd want to make it and then kind of keep it on you, because it takes a lot of work to make it. And like I said, you'd want to kind of, once you'd made it, you'd want to throw it away, because it would take a while to make it. But it will help make a fire quickly, even with one person, without with less effort than some of the other methods. The next way I would tell you is I think we already talked about flint and steel, but I'll go over that again. You can take the flint strikers, they make like a flint alloy of the strikers that they make. You can keep those. I keep those in my bags, in vehicles. I just had a lot of them. They were cheap, and I have them all over. You can get those. You can get the magnesium blocks. Are kind of work the same way. We'll talk about that in just a minute. With the flint strikers, now you can actually use regular flint rocks, chert flint, and any kind of steel that you can get your hand on. I believe that we use the Boy Scout pocket knife with the blades closed to strike against the flint rock when I was younger. You're just going to hold the flint. If you've got a flint rock, you'll break it so that you've got an exposed edge, like an exposed sharp edge. Then you'll take the closed pocket knife with the metal part, with the metal back of the blade sticking out, and you'll bring the pocket knife down in a short, sharp arc, contacts the edge of the flint, like you're striking it, but you're barely hitting it. You're striking it a glancing blow, and you'll keep doing that, and every time you do it, you will be snapping sparks off of the flint. Now, if you're familiar with the flintlock rifles, flintlock muskets, it's exactly what they did, right? What they did, they had a metal hammer that you would cock back. It would be under pressure of a spring. At the very end of the hammer would be a small vise. And you would take a piece of flint. Well, the flint had to be worked. You'd have to take it and break it and work it so that you had the right size and then that the edges were prepared correctly. And, they had a big factory business doing this of a bunch of folks sitting around breaking the flint up, making it into the right sizes so it could be used in the rifles. That would be held in the end of the hammer, like in a small vise. You would cock it back to full cock, and then when you released it, it would go forward onto a piece of metal that was L-shaped. And the L-shaped piece, it's a flat, kind of a wide piece of metal, about an inch to three-quarters of an inch wide, and it's shaped like an L, and then down at the bottom of the baseline of the L, where the end of the L is, it would be attached to the frizzin, the powder, a little pan that carried the powder. And what happened was whenever the hammer came forward, it would strike the metal at an angle. And as it was coming down and striking it, it would also pushing it away. It pushed it away, and that exposed an open depression that was filled with powder, with loose gunpowder. That loose gunpowder was connected to the main charge in the barrel of the rifle by a tiny hole. So when you talk about priming a rifle, that's what they would do. They would open up the frizzin pan, they would pour loose powder in and ensure that some of it went into the little hole that goes down into the base, into the bore of the rifle, and they would close the pan. Now, you would do this after you had loaded in your loose powder and your wadding and your ball and stuff, then you would pop open the frizzin, pour in the primer, shut it, pull the hammer back to a full cock, squeeze the trigger, the hammer goes forward, hits the plate in front of it, and that causes the flint to run down it at an angle, striking off a whole bunch of sparks, and as it's running down it, it's also opened up that ignites that loose gunpowder in there. That loose gunpowder goes through the hole into the barrel with the main charge, and that ignites the main charge, which propels the projectile out. That's how the flintlock works. You can do the same thing with the piece of raw flint and your pocket knife, or any kind of a piece of metal that you can find. You can do the same thing by striking the sparks. Once again, you're going to have to practice doing it. So that you can regularly strike off a nice stream of sparks every time you do it. And you're going to have to make sure that all of these sparks are being captured in your tinder ball that you've made. Like I said, I can't stress enough the importance of doing the work of preparing your tinder ball before you try anything else, any methods like the fire. is nothing's going to work until you have the tinder ball ready, okay? All right, so you've got the flint and steel, the bow drill, the hand spindle, the hand pump drill. You've got the matches. You've got the lighter. And one of the other things that you can use that you can usually find in different places, or you may have yourself, are you can use a magnifying glass or glass lenses to start a fire. If you've got reading glasses, those will work. And the way that you'll do this is, and most of you have tried at some point in your life, have tried this to get the sun to shine through the lenses, you know, and form a hot spot and cause something to smoke or catch on fire. Okay, as I said, you'll prepare your tinder. Make sure that you've got the tinder right to catch this, and you'll take those glasses. You'll let the sun come through the glasses, and then you will move the lens either closer to your tinder or farther away. What you're trying to do is to get that optimum point, and the way that you'll find it is whenever you move those glasses closer to the little dot that's shining through the glasses when you have the glasses set up correctly between the tinder and the sun. If you move it close to it and you see the dot getting bigger, then you stop. You start moving it back away from it. As you're moving it back away from it, you'll reach a point where it'll stop getting smaller and it'll start getting bigger again. Then you move it back again until you find that point where it has reached the smallest point it will make. All right? And that is going to be your focal length for the fire. When it has made the smallest dot it can make, that's going to be the distance that you keep holding it at until you can start your ember with it. Now, it'll take a little while for you to do it, and you'll need to focus the dot on the tinder that you're trying to get started in your tinder ball that you pre-prepared. You'll focus it on there until you get it to smoking, until you can finally see a little red ember, and you'll keep it on there. You'll keep it on there as you're gently, very gently, just blowing additional oxygen onto the ember, and you're keeping the smoke, the actual smoke, you're keeping the smoke away from either blocking out. You want the smoke to smother the ember out. You want to keep the smoke away, add fresh oxygen, and you don't want the smoke to get between the glasses and where the ember is hitting, where the magnified light is hitting the ember, because if you do, it'll lose its power by hitting the small particles in the smoke. So you're gently blowing until you've created a large enough ember, and then you continue to blow until that ember finally ignites and you get an open flame. And then once again, you set that down where you're going to have your fire, because you've already prepared the place for your fire too. You've already gotten a place ready for where you're going to have your fire. Either you've actually made a little formal thing out of rocks or whatever. You just made sure that you're not going to put it somewhere where it is going to be in danger, or where you're in danger of starting a fire that's out of control, or where your tinder ball is going to roll over and fall and break apart or something. You're going to have, you've planned it out so you have a place to put it. You put your tinder ball down with the glowing flame, and you'll start adding the little pencil thick pieces to it to get the fire started. That's your glasses or magnifying glass method. Now, can also use this is one that I have not tried lately. We tried it once as a group a couple of years ago, but you can also use parabolic glass to reflect the sun and concentrate the sun. And parabolic glass is like what you would get out of the old headlights, you know, the old curved headlights. And you can use a water-filled plastic bottle as well. Which certainly is going to take a little practice to get used to doing that correctly. And you'll have to have clear plastic and clear water in the bottle when you're doing it. Okay. If you have your vehicle or a flashlight, anything that has batteries in it, if you can get a couple of pieces of wire, and you get some very, very fine wire, or if you have some steel wool and some wire, then you can make a fire that way, using electricity, a fire. And you can certainly do it, if you have a car battery, you can certainly do it a lot easier. The larger the battery, the easier it is to get the heat, and the larger diameter wire you can use. The way that you would do it is you would take, if you're using steel wool, and some people keep steel wool in their kits just for this exact reason. You can take a small chunk of the steel wool and kind of roll it into kind of like a little bundle. Then you can take your battery, and you can take, it can be a 9 volt, it can be a C battery. I'm not sure if one of the single A's would do it. It might, but it would take some very fine wires. Anyway, you'll take the wires or wire, and you'll have to make sure that you get a charge from both sides. Now, if you only have like a little tiny piece of wire, I suppose you could hold your or put your steel wool like on the flat negative side, and then run your a small piece of wire from the positive side over to the steel wool that you are keeping in between the end of the wire and the battery, touch it, and the current, once you have it in direct contact, it will be causing a direct short, which will cause the steel wool to start glowing, and that is going to be then your ember that you will transfer to the tinder. And this isn't going to work without steel wool, so you'd have to make sure that you had your steel wool with you. Now, if you had a car battery, it'd be a little bit easier to do because you could use, a larger gauge wire. And what you would be trying to do then is to run the wire from one pole of the battery, and then another wire from the other pole, and then use something in between the two that was going to burn, that was thinner than the two wires that you were using, and you connect them together. That's where your tinder would be, and you would use that, the heat that's generated by the direct short, to make your fire. Now, there are plenty of other ways that you can start fire. You can Google this, the fire starting, and you'll see a lot of different ways that you can use objects to make fires. There is balloons and condoms that you can take and you can fill with water. And you try and make balloon of the condom, you try to make it as spherical as possible, because then what you want to do is to create as close as to an exact sphere as you can. Then what you're going to do is you're going to squeeze the balloon in such a way that you're making a shape that is going to focus the light as it's coming through the water, okay? This is something you'll certainly would have to take a lot of practice. Same thing with ice. If you're somewhere where you can find ice that has some nice clear ice where the sun can pass through it. Obviously, if it's dirty ice or if there's a lot of oxygen bubbles in it, it's not going to work. But you'd form the ice. You'd break out a piece of the ice out and try and form it into a lens shape. You know, you could use your fingers to slowly melt the ice as you're rubbing in a circular pattern to form it into like the shape of a lens. I mean, you would use it the same way you would use a magnifying glass or a pair of glasses. Like I said, the ice has to be clear. It can't be cloudy or anything like that. Probably one of the best ways to do this would be to, if you're somewhere where it's cold, would be to make it yourself. Make the ice yourself. Take some good clean water, and then you'll pour it into some kind of container that you've made yourself, like a little piece of plastic that you have that you suspended in such a way that you'll have a rounded shape on one side of it, and then let it freeze. All right. There is the Coke can and chocolate bar method. And this just happens to be things that you might actually have on you or something, out camping or something like that. What you would do with this is you're going to take you look at the bottom of the soda can and it's got that indented, almost like a parabolic curve indented on the bottom. Then you're going to take the chocolate from the chocolate bar and you're going to start rubbing it on the bottom of the can. And you're going to do this because the chocolate is going to be your polishing medium, okay? You're going to take the chocolate, you're going to take a little piece of cloth with the chocolate on it, and you're going to rub the bottom of the can until you've got that aluminum so shiny that it's like a mirror. You can use paste. It doesn't work quite as well because the toothpaste is actually kind of like a higher grit in it, but you can use it. After you polish the bottom of the can so that it's mirror shiny, basically you have the same kind of thing, which is a parabolic mirror, and the sunlight will reflect off the bottom of the can, forming a single focal point, and you'll point the bottom of the can towards the sun, and you'll have you'll end up with a light that you can then focus directly at the tinder, and the tinder is going to be about an inch from the reflecting light's focal point. Now, after a few seconds, or more, depending on how long it takes you to, how well you've done your polishing job, and how long it takes you to find the right angle, it should be just like the magnifying glass. You should be able to, and you'll have to suspend the tinder, at that in the center point right there. But there are a lot of ways that you can actually start the fire. So the only thing I would tell you, or let me tell you the two major things, is one, practice laying the fire. The way that you lay the fire is going to determine your ability to get fire. You know, the way that you are going to lay the fire is going to, it's going to determine if your fire makes it or not, all right? And that includes building your tinder cup. So practice building your tinder cup. So that's going to be, that's a make or break part of this. And second thing I'll tell you is that all of these methods require practice to make them work. The flint steel one, I've got that to where, to me, for me, that's really just as fast as a match or a lighter. Okay, because I've done that one so often. The hand drill and bow drill less often, because they take a lot longer. It takes longer to make. It takes more work to get the ember. So, but I still do practice it every now and then because I want to make sure that I. Make sure that I don't forget how to produce an ember with it. But the only way that this, that you're going to get this to work is by practicing it. Now, you see these folks on these survival shows. I mean, I've seen them several times before where the folks are supposed to be, they're supposed to be experts. But they can't start a fire with a simple bow drill. Doesn't seem very expert to me, because you can figure out a way to make it work. It's like I said, it can certainly be difficult, but you can figure out a way to make it work. And especially these guys, like one of the guys I just recently saw do this and who failed at it, they were on a beach, which is like the perfect place to find spindles. And fireboards and everything else. But they apparently weren't as expert as they had indicated they were, because I think it took them 4 or 5 days to start the fire. Fire is one of those things that if you're in a survival situation, that should be right up at the top of your list. Fire and finding good, safe, clean water to drink. And you're going to need the fire to purify the water. So fire should be right up at the top of your list in a survival situation. I don't care if you're in the desert or you're in the Alps. Fire is going to be one of the things that you need right off the bat. All right? So make sure that you are, number one, that you're putting away the easy things to use to make the fire, that you got plenty of the little butane lighters, plenty of matches stored away, plenty of butane lighters, all that stuff, and then spend a little time working with your flint and steel some weekend. Just tell yourself, okay, on Saturday, I'm gonna go out, I'm gonna gather up some stuff, and you're gonna gather up several different types of wood for the spindle, several types of wood for the fireboard, and such different types of wood for the bow and for the cap, and you're going to make yourself a fire using that method, okay? You can go to Google, and I'm sure that they'll have a how to start a bow drill fire video. They've got to have it, and use that as your guide, okay? But practice doing it now so that if you ever have to do it, you're not having to learn how to do it. You're just having to do it, okay? All right. One of the things that we wanted to talk about last time was storing your bulk grain, and that is, when you're buying grain, you want to, whether no matter what it is, rice, cracked wheat, hard wheat, oats, whatever it is, you want to buy it in bulk so that you get a good price on it, and then you want to be able to store it safely so that insects and vermin can't get to it. And the best way to do this is you can buy it in bulk, and you can put it in like the 5 gallon or 50 gallon. You know, if you want to store a lot of it, you can certainly get the those big 50 gallon food grade, either metal or plastic containers. You can buy the Mylar bags that will fit those too. And then you want to make sure that it stays dry. That's by putting the desiccants in it, and that it has an unbreathable atmosphere in it to keep vermin out. One of the best ways you can do that is you can use dry ice. You know, you get your bucket hill set up with to put the dry ice in it. For a 5 gallon bucket, you can put a quarter pound of dry ice in the bottom of the 5 gallon bucket. You can then fill the pail 3/4 full of wheat and then set the lid on the top. Now, you don't seal it yet. After about 2 hours, when you're pretty sure that all the dry ice has exchanged into a gas, then you can seal the pail. Now, that replaces all of the oxygen inside with CO2. Now, bugs can't live in that, but it also has to be airtight too, right? So make sure that you are, and I told you guys before too, that not knowing how to do this stop you from doing it, okay? And don't let not having all of the equipment or all of the materials stop you from doing it. At the very end of the day, go get some 5 gallon food grade buckets from Walmart, Home Depot, Lowe's. Take those, fill those to the top with your dry grain, put the top back on, tap them into place and lock them, and put that in your storage bin, okay? Make sure you put the dates on of when you canned that particular one up. You can certainly go the full route by putting the 5 gallon buckets, putting the liners in, putting your grain inside, then putting the CO2 on the top and sealing it up, making sure that you've left some room for the air to escape out of there, and then lock that down tight. You can certainly do that, but don't let not having the bags keep you from going getting the grain and putting it away, all right? Because it's one of the least expensive things to get and to store is the grain. All right. And you can buy rice, and you can buy rice in 50-pound sacks. I'm sure that if you're close to one of the places, you could buy a truckload of it. You know, even loosen your truckload or bring your own containers, and they would fill them up and weigh them for you. And if you have some way to do that, that's perfect. If you have some way to can up 50-gallon cans, seal those up, that would be perfect. And we also wanted to talk about medicine, and I'm going to limit it right now to biotics. Let's talk about that for a minute. Let's talk about buying antibiotics from the pet stores, okay? Because for you to go and get an antibiotic from the doctor, you'd have to write you a prescription. And then your insurance company is going to want to know, why do you need these antibiotics? And we're not paying for them. And a lot of times now, even if you had a doctor who would write you a prescription for them, I've certainly seen the pharmacies not want to allow you to get something that your insurance wasn't paying for because they don't want you to pay cash for it. So what are you going to do? You don't want to go in and fake an illness. I guess you could, but here is an alternative. The antibiotics that we take as humans are also the same antibiotics that are prescribed for fish. The difference is when you go to the pet store, they don't make you get a prescription for the exact same antibiotics. Now, before we go any further with this, let me make sure you understand that you guys out there listening, you are the ones that are 100% responsible for anything you're doing with any of the information I'm giving you, okay? There's nothing I can do from my end to stop you from doing something or make you do it right or whatever, all right? And I'm also not going to go over any kind of a dosage with this because I'm not a doctor. So I'm just going to tell you what these medications are, and then you can figure out what you need to do about it. Now, here's the other thing I'll tell you about the antibiotics, too, is that antibiotics, one type of antibiotic isn't a cure-all for everything. They make antibiotics to specifically different maladies. So you need to make sure you're taking the correct antibiotic in the appropriate dosage to target a specific malady, all right? But if you go to the pet store, and the other thing is, if you get sick, don't be going to the pet store and getting antibiotics and treating yourself, okay? Go to the doctor, find out what's really wrong with you, and then get the prescription that way. These antibiotics are to be used only in a grid down, end of the world type situation where you have no other choices. That's the information that I'm giving you. All right. If you go to the fish store, they're going to have the fish antibiotics, and they were really cheap until they found out people were buying them and stocking up on them for their use at the end of the world situation. So they kind of gone up quite a bit now, but they're still less expensive usually than prescriptions. If you go to the store, the fish store, and you see the name Fish Mox, Fish M-O-X, that's going to be amoxicillin in the 250 milligram base, okay? Fish Mox, that's amoxicillin in the 250 milligram base. Fish Mox Forte is the amoxicillin in 500 milligram dosage. Fish Flex is Keflex, 250 milligram dosage of Keflex. Fish Flex Forte is the Keflex in the 500 milligram dosage. Fish Zole is the metronidazole, 250 milligram. And Fish Pen is penicillin, 250 milligram. And Fish Pen Forte is penicillin in 500 milligram dosage. Okay, so that's the fish names for the human antibiotics.
Scout,
now,
do you have a second here?
Yeah. What you got?
One of the things that will really help people when they're dealing with these animal medications that you find is if they go to the local used bookstore and hunt around for a copy of something called a PDR. It's called a Physician's Desk Reference.
Right.
And it's a reference book on drugs. It has information on what the stuff is good for, dosing and identifying different drugs. It's a handy reference for that. And if you happen to go buy, say, a bottle of Fish Mox, if you look at the pill, it'll have a company name and a number on there. And you can go to the identification section and look up that company name and number, and it will assure you that it is, in fact, the same stuff that they prescribe for people. And it gives information on how much would be necessary for particular situations or particular diseases, and gives you an idea of what diseases a particular drug would be good for treating. And you can pick up a used PDR for $3 or $4 in your local used bookstore. Over in the reference section, you have a hard time getting rid of them. And it's one of the handiest things you can have around.
Yeah, I would certainly. We're going to have a we have a whole show on exactly what you're talking about, and that is the reference material, because I've been stockpiling it for quite a while and going through different books and stuff, so that we could so that I had a good way of trying to figure out, because I'm not a doctor, a good way of trying to figure out what and I won't have any interest in that service there to use my WebMD. But that is a good book. There are a lot of other ones that you can get also. Now, you know, the other warning that I would give folks is when you're taking antibiotics, you need to take them the way they are meant to be taken. And that includes, taking them all the way through their cycle, so that you have killed off the bug, because antibiotics are one of the greatest success stories in modern medicine. But because of misuse and abuse of them, they're rapidly becoming ineffective. What we're doing is we're breeding the superbugs because of the improper techniques of taking them and use and abuse them, so that in 15 or 20 years there's not going to be any good anything to take, because everything is going to be resistant. All the diseases are going to be resistant to antibiotics. So, in 15 or 20 years, when you go to the hospital to have an operation or something, the thing that's going to kill you is not any of the operation. It's going to be some little routine infection, some little bug that's going to kill you, because antibiotics are no longer going to work, right? Okay, as with any information about medicine or anything else, I highly suggest that you do your own research, that you talk to medical professionals, and that if you have something wrong with you, you go to the doctor, all right? Go to the doctor and get them to check you out and find out what's wrong. Okay, I want to finish up tonight with talking about the last 11 days. We've been running a 5-day precision rifle course, and then a 2-day stalking and camouflage course here at Battle Road USA. And this was a really great week. We had a lot of great instruction. We did a lot of shooting at distance for the rifle course, and it worked out really well. The precision rifle course had us shooting at targets up to 850 meters, And all of the shooters did a great job. John had some really great instruction. And one of the things that we added in this time was a section on barricades. We added in a section on shooting through barricades. And I wanted just to tell you a little bit about what I learned about the section on glass. And that is that the shooting through glass can be a little bit tricky, and you'll need to pay attention to how you're doing it. That is because usually when you're shooting through glass, mostly a case like for law enforcement. You know, they're shooting through glass at somebody that's taken a hostage or something like that. And careful, because your bullet, when you fire a bullet from a rifle, it goes through several stages. And the first stage is called nutation. And in nutation, it's kind of comparable to, when you've got a top and you zip the spring off the top real fast, and the top is really wobbly at first. It's kind of wobbling back and forth until it kind of slows down just a little, and then it'll go into that good steady spin. Well, your bullet does the same thing. As the bullet is leaving the barrel, it's hitting the rifling, and the rifling is imparting a spin to the bullet to help stabilize it in flight. And it does. And it does a great job of it. However, when it first leaves the barrel, and that could be anywhere from 75 to like 150 yards or more, there's that the area before that is where the bullet is in nutation, up to 100 yards. That means it hasn't stopped the back and forth movement of it. It hasn't gone into a steady spin yet. The next section will be called sleep. Your bullet first exits the barrel in nutation, kind of a yaw going on it back and forth. Then it goes into sleep. And you want to make sure that if you're firing through glass or something, that if you can't get your target up near the glass, right up against the glass, that you need to move back so that your bullet is entered its sleep period before it hits the glass. That's because when the bullet is in nutation, even something thin like a glass window pane can cause it to deviate even greatly kind of from its point of impact. We had single pane glass windows and the thick automotive glass. And what we did is we set them up at 5, 10, and 15 foot of distance between the target and the glass. And we had the shooters shooting through the glass at 50, 100, and 200 yards. And if you look at one of the pictures that is on the slideshow for the show, there's a slideshow on the show page, you'll see one of them marked 5 feet. I believe it's 5 feet and 50 feet or 5 feet and around 100 feet. I don't remember which slide I put up there. Regardless, there's a shot that was taken fast, which was only 5 feet from the target. And the target was the bridge of the nose at that spot, but on a line from between the center of the two eyes where it intersects the nose line. that was the point of aim. The point of impact was actually close to 3 inches or more off to the left. It was just to the outside of the eyebrow of the target's face. And on top of that, the bullet was exactly flat. The bullet had come in nutation, in a yaw. The bullet had struck the window glass, and when it did, in just 5 feet, it caused it to move a little over 3 inches and to impact sideways. That is that's a lot of deviation. And it would have been more if the target would have been back, 10 or 15 feet. It would have been a miss, I'm sure, at either the 10 or 15 foot mark, because the angle of the deviation was so great. So that tells you that, we had different types of ammunition we were using as well. We were using various full metal jackets on the window glass at different distances, and we were using some nice expensive Hornady AMAX, the 168-grain 308 shell. And while it was the most accurate round, it also had troubles with fragmentation when hitting the glass. So the short side of the story, the information gained, would be this, that if you're going to be shooting through glass at a target, you need to do one of two things. You either need to get the target to come to the window, or you need to move back beyond 200 feet in order to make the shot, because you want to make sure that your bullet is in sleep. Before you make the shot, all right? Okay, the other course, the stocking and camouflage course, was a great course, and we had a couple of hours of classroom, then went straight into the practical application. First thing we did was have the students build their concealed positions, and they just took about an hour and a half to build their concealed position, and it was approximately 150 meters away from the observation point. And then we brought in the observer to walk a spotter onto the positions, and I believe that we got just about everybody. What we did is we'd give them they were in their concealed positions, and then they would have two blank rounds. And whenever I would go from position to position, I'd get about 30, 40 feet away, and I would tell them to take their shot if he hadn't seen them already, because he picked out a couple of the guys before they even took their shots. They would take a shot at him, and then with the blanks, and then I'd walk to within 10 feet, and he would look again. If he couldn't see them, then he had asked them to identify a letter. It was on an 8x10 sheet of paper. Identify a letter he was holding up to make sure that they could actually see him from their position. Once they identified it, then they would fire a second shot. And if he still couldn't find them after that, he'd hold up another letter. They had identified that, and then they had made it. I mean, they made their hide good enough that they could take two shots. And even with me standing in within 5 feet of the person's hide, couldn't be identified. Okay? The next problem was a stalking to your hide position. And then the same thing with firing the shots. And we started off about 250, 300 meters away from the observer's position. and they would have to stalk up to it to where they could get a good clean shot, whether that was from, you know, 200 meters or 50 meters, whatever, in between there. They stalked up to where they could get a good clean shot, take the shot, and they would go through the same thing. Now, if they were seen before that, they would have to reset. I mean, they'd have to get up, walk back to the beginning, and start their stalk over. And that was also a four-point loss out of their total of 20 points. You had to make 16 points in order to pass this phase. The next day, we repeated this with three stalk and on three different lanes, three different stalking lanes. The last two were live fire stalks. And that meant that they would stalk up to the position where they would take their shot. I'd go to 10 feet, they'd try and find them. Go to 5 feet, try and find them. And, if they couldn't be found, then they would leave their rifle at that position, and at the end of this problem, they would go back to that point. They'd have one live round that we'd give them, and they'd need to make a shot on the target, which would be a steel plate that I'd been sitting in front of while I was trying to catch them. They'd have to hit the target from that position. And they did two of those, and that finished up the course, and along as well with a lot of work on camouflage, on movement, and stuff like that. All right, guys, we're at the end of the show for tonight. I want to thank everybody for listening. And once again, if you got anything that you want to hear, any show that you want to, any subjects that you want to see on the show, any guests, anything like that, just send me an email or a message or anything like that, and I'll be glad to do my best to get that show topic on for you. All right, we'll see you guys again next Thursday, 7 p.m. Central. Until then, God bless and keep you all.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.